Yes, I think we're ready. All right, well, good morning, everyone. It's 10:04 a.m. on Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. This is an information exchange, if you will, with the North Dakota Petroleum Conference and the North Dakota Public Service Commission. We're waiting on Commissioner Fedorchak. Her items are here, but she stepped out for a second. But again, I've introduced myself. I look forward to the discussion ahead. I see we have four listed agenda items. The last one, other policy issues or concerns, may turn out to be more than just one particular thing. So we'll see how that goes. But before I turn it over to Commissioner Fedorchak, this is her portfolio. Commissioner Christman, do you have any questions or comments, I should say?
I do not. I'll probably have plenty of comments and questions as we go, but I'd just as soon just get into the meat of things and go ahead and proceed with the meeting.
All right.
But thanks, everybody, for being here.
Okay. And, Julie, we've got our Commissioner Fedorchak. We have our intros on both Randy and I. And Brady's on and Ron Ness is on, as well as a host of other people. So I'll turn it over to you.
Excellent. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for participating. This isn't as much fun of a venue as it is when we can sit down face to face, but it's still a really important opportunity for us to get together. It's been a while since we've had a chance to discuss some of these things, so this seemed like a good time. Ron and I were visiting over the course of the last month or so about the legislative session coming up and what sorts of things the commission is has in the hopper, and just a variety of other issues, so it seemed like we should definitely get together and discuss this. So how do I see who's – I only see a couple faces. How do I see who's on here in participants, Matt? Those people all are active participants? Oh, good. Wow, we have a great group.
Excellent. Matt, are you able to reorder those? So, like, since we can't get everybody on the screen, caller three or something like that, maybe they don't need on the screen. If we could at least have the ones with names.
Oh, no, this just shows participant
list.
And then there we go. So most people don't have their cameras going. Okay. All righty. Say that again, Matt. Probably just the ones who are, unless everyone, when you talk, if you will make your video camera active, then that would be, then we can actually see who's talking. That would be great as we go. Ron, did you want to make any opening comments as well, or did he already do that?
No, okay. We haven't gotten that far
then
yet.
Let's have Ron say a couple words, and then we'll get into the rest of the agenda.
And Ron, if you are talking, you'll have to unmute your mic. There you go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
My technological expertise is clearly at question here. My staff is all able to be online, and I've got like two systems going here. So first of all, thanks to Commissioner Fedorchak. This is her idea. We've got 42 folks on the call, so obviously a great idea, very timely. And I think, you know, a couple of things that we've gotten a little bit away, maybe COVID, maybe a little bit of just lack of issues, but the quarterly meetings that we had here over the past, 3 years, I think have proven extremely valuable. Last legislative session was, I think, a testament of that. We were kind of all very informed of what the issues were going forth, and we were all engaged, and I thought things went obviously better than they probably have the previous five sessions in terms of coming out with, clear positive legislation that was beneficial to all parties and a good direction. So we're glad to be here today. I think I'm a little bit interested in terms of what the commission has on its plate today in terms of are there projects, from an industry standpoint, from my shoes, things are, humming along out in the field. We're harvesting every day, but on the E&P side and the in the development side, things have obviously slowed substantially. We need that that infrastructure to continue to be built when timely and when appropriate for the companies to do that. So we want to engage on this stuff. And the other thing that I will say is that when we're able to get back to having some meetings in person, I think that there have been a lot of personnel changes, certainly on the industry side of the world. We've probably got new faces, and from an agency standpoint, I'm not sure we've got the same engagement and relationships with some of your core staff up there that we need to have, at least from speaking for myself. So we're very interested to know from your standpoint of what's going on with your team and what you're looking at this session in terms of personnel needs or changes or anything like that. So thanks to everybody for participating today, taking the time to do this, and thank you specifically to the commissioners for engaging with us and letting us know what's coming forth from you guys legislatively.
Excellent. Thank you, Ron. So I think that in terms of what's happening here and what's going on at the commission, we do have a number of staff changes. I'll mention a couple of those in a minute. But currently, as my memory recalls, we have two active pipeline project applications. One is for a small alteration on a pipeline, refined gas pipeline near Fargo as a result of the diversion project there. And then we have another smaller transmission or line in the west. During COVID, so when COVID hit, it was right at the beginning of the siting season and permitting season last spring. And so we were really anxious about not slowing things up, and which could have easily resulted in long delays or the loss of the construction season because of the requirements in law that call for us having in-person hearings at the location of where the infrastructure is being built. So we appealed to Governor Burgum, who gave us a waiver of that and allowed us to have these emergency, under the emergency declaration, and allowed us to have remote hearings via technology. We feel we've learned a lot from those. We think that actually there might be better access for the public. I think we all share the desire to return to the communities because we like being out in the communities where this stuff is being constructed and proposed, and hearing from the public and interacting with the staff right there as well. But without the ability to do that, this was a really great way to proceed, and we didn't miss a beat. I don't think maybe one of our hearings was delayed a couple of weeks. But otherwise, thanks to Jack's great work and working with the other legal beagles in the state to get the right changes made in the law and also or adjustments, and then also getting the right notices out in a timely manner, we were able to hold the schedules and have those hearings and permit the infrastructure. And there was a number of examples, including a gas processing facility that was permitted and is under construction, probably near completion as we speak. So I think that I have to tip my hat to Jack and the other staff who really pushed things along. Our IT staff, Steve and Matt Kluzak, came up with the technology to make it happen. We had great participation by the public. And so I think it all worked really seamlessly. I would like to, in terms of staff changes, since our last legislative session, we have new general counsel. Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco retired after many, many, many years of service here, and we promoted Jack Hsu, who many of you have worked with in the past. He's been at the commission for 5 years, Jack? How long?
Six in January.
Time flies. we all were unanimous in believing he was the right person for the job. And he's doing a great job as our general counsel, and he's going to speak to us in a few minutes. And then we hired a new um, a, assistant attorney, Brian Johnson. He is now under Jack in our legal division and works largely with the public utilities division, but also gets assigned to other cases as necessary as we need help. And Brian comes with lots of great experience as well and has really hit the ground running. And so you'll get to meet him down the road. I look forward to that opportunity. I think all of our staff, our analysts, are the same. Adam Renfant is on board and does a lot of the siting things. Jerry Lean and Pat Fawn. And then the final person in our public utilities division is Victor Shook. He doesn't do as much siting. He does a lot of the economic regulation for the utility industry, but does do all the one-call enforcement stuff, too. So you occasionally may hear from Victor in that regard. Hopefully not, but sometimes, yes. So that rounds out our public utilities division, and look forward to introducing you all to our new members there down the road. In terms of the agenda, I would like to just quickly make one change to the order. If we could move the PSC tree and shrub guidelines up to the top, and then everything else will kind of flow more naturally, I think I'd like to take that piece first, and then we can move into the PSC legislation, the footprint tweaks, and other policy issues or concerns. And really on the PSC tree and shrub guidelines, that was our placeholder to get reaction from all of you, any of you who have used it. We've seen the new revised plans coming through on a number of projects, and hopefully this will accomplish what we're all trying to accomplish, which is better results in the end. It's far less prescriptive and provides a lot more flexibility, which I think is great because it allows a little more creativity and innovation and the industry able to meet the needs, which is really just improving the environment and creating more habitat out there as a result of all the investments in the tree and shrub mitigation. So I'm going to open it up to all of you to share with us how you think it's working so far and any concerns or suggestions you have moving forward. If anybody is talking, you have to unmute because we can't hear you. I see Carrie's mic is open.
She doesn't have audio.
Oh, she doesn't have audio.
Unless she called in too.
I think this is maybe a situation where people are waiting for someone else to speak first. Do you want to just call a few people or call on
Ron, do you have any thoughts?
I do, and I will ask, maybe Darren Snow and a few others that were heavily involved in that to chime in. But I think from our standpoint, that's worked out very well, and they seem to be very common sense, reasonable changes that the commission implemented. We've got a tree planting program, and I think that we're well over 100,000 trees that we planted now, and Tessa and I were just visiting yesterday. Our success ratio on I think there's not a project that's been under 60%, but we're planting huge volumes of trees, and it just seems like if we step back 5 years, the program that was in place was just becoming a nightmare. The landowners in McKenzie County and the Big Four counties basically had enough land taken out of production already. They didn't want tree rows. We were having to pay. They didn't care about them. They didn't. They weren't their trees. And the system now is one which we can truly grow habitat, and we can truly grow trees where trees want to be grown and where landowners want them to be grown. And it seems like these are reasonable changes, and I think common sense on the we all get from being out in the. In the North Dakota farm communities, is landowners are very specific about where and how they want trees, and the ones that they get where they want them, and when they want them, and where they want them, they take care of them, and it turns out to be a great project. So as opposed to it being kind of a punishment in a forced process. I think we've got one now that with ESG and other opportunities, I think that we can far succeed any obligations and something that industry needs to be committed to. We've got a long list of landowners who want trees that we can only get to so many in our tree program. So I think companies can utilize those landowners that are coming to us and maybe use the soil conservation districts or other methods to get trees planted. And I, beyond trees, I think that other types of habitat should continue to be considered, because it's not just all about trees. It's talk to landowners and truly understand conservation. So I'd be really interested to hear from the companies on this.
Same. Darren, are you out there? I don't know if I see your name on this list.
He's on the list.
Okay. There he is. Darren, if you're talking, we can't hear you, but maybe you're preoccupied right now, so... If there are any others who want to pipe in, Ken or Danette?
Good morning, Commissioners. I will. This is Danette Welsh. Just wanted to say I very much echo what Ron has to say about the tree and shrub program. I have not heard any complaints, if you will, internally from our folks who've been working through this process on a number of projects. So we're very grateful for the changes that were made and the flexibility that you've been offering in that program. So far, so good for us.
Very good. Ken? Thank you.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that anytime you can have some common sense solutions, I think it's a good idea. And that seems to be what we landed on here. So applaud the PSD for going down that road, and those of you like Darren who put so much time into it, and others, well done.
Yeah. Very good. Well, thank you to the industry for working so closely with us on developing that new program. From my perspective, I think one of the keys that I'm looking for is in the reporting of the outcomes, we really left that open-ended in terms of really just asking the companies to describe how the program reached the goals, which were, you know, very general, like improving habitat, et cetera, protecting the environment. Describe how you accomplished that. And that description is what I'm really hoping for to be well done and really be the way that we can show to the public that this program is accomplishing the goals much. And, you know, we don't have to refer to the old program, but at least as good as, if not better than, just counting the number of trees that have survived. So I think we have a potential to have a great success story here for the industry, for regulators, to show how you really are making an impact on the environment in a positive way through this reclamation process. And so I'm looking forward to seeing that reflected in the way that you describe the outcomes in your final report back to us. So... looking forward to that, Rand.
I've plucked Tessa out of her office here. I'm going to use a moment while we have a captive audience here for a shameless plug, and also let companies know what we've got for really opportunities that you can engage in and get some trees planted if you have obligations coming up and or become a supporter of her tree planting initiative. So here's Tessa.
Great.
Hi, Tess. Sorry, I don't have like great numbers here, but I can give a general estimate of what we're planning on planting for 2021. We have 11 projects that we are expecting to do. We have a couple companies that are going to take a few of those projects, but overall we're looking at probably planting about 25,000 trees, of which maybe half are already claimed, so we would still have at least 10,000 trees or shrubs that that we would be planting that aren't quote-unquote, I guess, or for lack of a better word, claimed for any kind of tree and shrub mitigation.
We really haven't done any advertising on this probably over a year, because every time we do, we get landowners that come out of the woodwork, and right now we just have to put them on a multi-year waiting list. So we've got potential and opportunity here to substantially grow this program. We may need to develop another tree planting specialist or two to find somebody out there with a passion to want to do this and load them up with the right equipment. But the opportunity is here. So if companies out there have needs or want to participate, definitely your contact person.
Very good. Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Tessa, for that update. Sounds great. Randy had a thought.
Well, my thought was I was going to ask about the plans for 2021, but then Tessa was, as typical, ahead of me and provided it. But I do that did bring up a question. Then, what do you by claimed? Do you mean that they're associated now with a project that removed some trees and shrubs, and so they're being used in this program? Or do you mean that only about half of them, you have a place to plant them in the spring?
So there's a company that plans to use them for their tree and shrub replacement.
So the others would be planted anyway. They just wouldn't be a part of any mitigation.
Correct. Yep.
Outstanding. Good work.
Very good. Thank you, Tessa. Okay, so one more thing I want to throw out there, and maybe staff are going to cringe at this, but I feel like we have, on previous permits, some companies have come back to us and said, well, originally we were under the old regime, and we'd like to move over to the new regime. I think we've done that at least once, maybe twice. Darren can probably speak to it, because I think it was a project that he was involved in, but personally, I'm open to that. If companies are going down the path or haven't started their tree and shrub plan for a project that's been constructed or under construction and wants to try to go a different route, I think that I'd be open to seeing that application and revising the approach on the tree and shrub from a previously permitted project. So certainly give us a shout and contact us and see how we can work through that. Okay. I think that probably concludes the tree and shrub. If nobody else has anything to add, we can move on. And we'll tackle the proposed PSC legislation next. Brady and Danette have participated in a lot of our legislative discussions over the course of the last few months, so they've been keeping tabs on this. We aren't going to go through everything we're proposing, just the things that we think you guys are interested in. And so to do that, I'm going to turn it over to Jack Hsu, our attorney, who's also leading the charge for us on legislation this year, to highlight a couple of the items that we think you guys are most interested in, and we would like your feedback. We don't have a lot of time now because the deadline for agency bills is this week, so any issues that you have, we'll work through yet and get those tweaked out today and tomorrow and get it done. So, Jack, thanks.
Thank you, Julie. I'll just give a quick recap. A lot of the things that we are proposing under 4922.1 are really just cleanup items, changing of subsections and so forth. But a couple of substantive items that just, if you aren't already aware of them, that might be worth discussing is one is the waiver of time procedures and schedules. As it currently is written, it makes it seem like we need to have a hearing to do a waiver of time procedures and schedules. And the commission would like, and we think would be beneficial to the industry for who would like to request a waiver of time procedures and schedules, to just be able to have a notice of opportunity issued and allow us to take action on that. And so really that's just a major clarification we put into the proposed legislation. Another couple changes that we made were under the public hearings, and now we've made it so that if there's an emergency that we'd be able to do a remote participation hearing if the commission deems there is an emergency. So it really puts the ball in our court as opposed to trying to go out there and soliciting executive orders of any sort of emergency that we feel exists and not rely on outside sources. Under that same section, 4922-10, we also made a minor alteration that allows us to move the siting hearing to the nearest adequate location if we can, or we are unable to find an adequate location within the county. Moving forward a little bit, we did make request a change or are proposing a change to the siting process expense recovery, 4922.1-21. And what we've run into is there the lower end of that siting fee, application fee that we receive at times has been, quite honestly, we've barely been able to actually meet all the requirements of the law with that fee, that $10,000 base fee. So if we go over that if we require additional money, what the law requires us to do then is to go to the emergency commission, which, of course, we all know it would push off all decision-making. It could push off hearings and so forth. And we'd rather not get tangled up in a bureaucratic mess. So to, I guess, alleviate the concerns of that, what we have proposed is if the application agrees to it, they can pay the additional fees up to $25,000. That would allow us to usually cover the vast majority of the costs, including ALJs, electronic recordings, publishing notices, attorneys, and so forth, and travel costs, without actually having to go to the emergency commission, going to the emergency commission in the event that that occurs. 4922.1-22.
Hold on, Jack. Sorry. Just one second on that. I just want to reinforce that one because I think it's an important change, but it also might raise red flags because it would require additional application fees from you. But I just want to reinforce that what we're changing is that rather than going to the emergency commission, we can talk to the applicant and say, we don't have enough money to process this. Do you agree to pay it? And if the applicant agrees to pay it, then we can move ahead without having to go to the emergency commission, which would delay. It doesn't say that if the applicant doesn't agree, that we can't go to the emergency commission. It still allows us to do it, and we can still do that if we feel that we just cannot move forward without the additional funds. But it allows us to avoid that step and work it out directly with the applicant, which I would imagine will be pretty amenable, especially if we go through all the costs and show that we've done everything we can to reduce our costs on our end. So that's the key change there, and hopefully that seems reasonable from your guys' standpoint. Thanks, Jack.
You're welcome.
Commissioner, Ron, just a question here. I assume that you're going through these interested in input.
Yes.
As opposed to text to me from people saying, I don't like this. All right. So you're soliciting input from the callers today, I assume, right?
We are. Very most certainly. Please speak up now.
And maybe this is a good spot to just break in Jack's presentation to, if there's thoughts on these, as opposed to getting through a longer list.
Questions also include further clarification or opportunities. Everybody, this is our chance now. It's so much better this way than when a bill gets introduced and in front of a committee that we can provide some positive input today and know what's coming.
Absolutely. If we miss something or if you have concerns about what you're hearing, maybe we just need to clarify it or we're missing something, so please let us know. And we have more opportunities as we go, so we'll keep moving, and we can go back to other bills if you want to. So go ahead, Jack.
Sure. So now we have a 4922.1-22, and this is a new section that allows for approval of temporary operations or variances. The circumstances that have arisen in the last year, there have been a number of changes in operations of pipelines, and quite honestly, there isn't a procedural mechanism that really allows us to address short-term changes in operations. And so we created a new section that allows us to approve temporary operations of facilities or create a variance from existing facility operations that have already been permitted for a short period of time. And along with those variances, the new proposed section does not require us to hold a hearing or do publications and so forth, since it is of temporary nature. And so really what we're hoping is that that allows us the flexibility to be responsive on a short-term basis, as well as provide opportunities for the companies who could see a benefit of change in operations to provide to or to request a variance from the commission, so without doing a much more cumbersome process of requesting an amendment or filing a new application.
So that one, as Jack said, is a direct result of a request that we had from one of your members this past year for this type of a variance. And we found a way to allow that. And this just allows us to clarify in the law that, that what we did is the appropriate way to handle that. And it just makes it really clear that that's allowed. And we all felt that it was the right decision. The infrastructure is in the ground. It's in place. It's silly to have not have the flexibility to make those kind of accommodations. So I think that we felt, again, as Ken was saying, this was a common sense type of thing. But we want to make sure that this doesn't get – no one gets tangled up in this in the future. Randy?
Well, I would say in that previous case – I agree with you. I think it sure seemed like the right thing to do. I always felt like I was nervous about our legal standing to be able to do it, and this will fix that.
And I note that not only does it allow us to do it, but it allows us to do it quickly, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without the notice of, or without a hearing.
With any publication at all.
Yeah. Yep. All right, and that, again, I saw Todd Cranda on the list, and I don't know if Todd has been tracking our stuff or been seeing the changes, but we can certainly get you these proposed changes, you, Todd, and anybody else, so you can see them and respond accordingly. We can even give you a deadline for responding if need be after this meeting, so you can see everything in writing and let us know.
There are really only two additional changes, and there would be a new section 4922.124, protection of cultural or historic site data. At times, we've run into circumstances where we weren't really sure where the information was coming from or how it can be protected, and we really don't want to publicly provide historic data or archaeological data to the public when they make such requests. And so this makes it abundantly clear, in addition to SHPO's protections, that we can hold on to this information but not be required to provide it to the public. And finally, there was one small section, too. If you all recall, when the Siting Act split into electrical and hydrocarbon, there was a remnant that for electrical safety that remained in the hydrocarbon portion of the Siting Act, and we're essentially just removing that and putting it into the electrical side.
Okay. Thank you, Jack. Any questions out there for Jack on any of these proposals or thoughts?
Commissioners, this is Danette Welsh with One Earth again. Just wanted to thank you. Thank you, Jack, for the changes that you're proposing here. We've done some looking at this, and I've had some conversations with Jack as well. I think we're generally pretty comfortable with what you're proposing. Like you, in the legislative discussions that you've had over the past month or two, we do have a little bit of concern about the change on page 30, whether or not to define good cause. There's benefits and detractors to that. So no matter where you go, I guess it's a win or a lose. So, but we really do appreciate the approach that you've taken here, and I think by and large, FONO can support what you've done.
And good cause on the variance. That's what you're talking about. How we determine that.
So yeah. So it says under the approval for temporary operation or variance that you would need to show good cause.
Yeah.
And you've had discussion in the past about whether or not that should be defined.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a win and a lose either way you do it.
Right. I think it's in keeping with a lot of the language that is used in the commission's law and giving us that flexibility to take in information and not get too prescriptive in the law. So good reason to elect smart commissioners.
Exactly.
All
I think
right.
This is where we open it up for criticism.
Yeah. Oh man, funny.
Commissioners, this is Ken Dockler again with Bridger, and I want to applaud you. I think it was a good time for me to step in because I think what you guys showed earlier this year in working through that process for a temporary operation or variance was really did show some smarts and. And I think Jack and his team did a great job in supporting you in that. And I think putting it in the code, we can wrestle over a good cause. That's a good question. We can wrestle around that, and we probably will. When it gets in the legislative floor, I'm sure there'll be some arm wrestling on that. But I think overall, I with Annette would suggest that we can support the changes that you proposed here. These all look like great common sense, again, approaches, and I appreciate that. So.
Excellent. Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Danette. Okay. I want to throw in, before we go to potential tweaks to the footprint law, I want to talk about two other things that aren't really captured in our legislative proposals. One of them is captured in our budget proposal. And the other is just something that's kind of come up in the last couple of weeks in discussion with Industrial Commission. So the first one is a budget proposal. As many of you know, all of you know, the governor's budget request included a number of reductions for state agencies. We fell in the category of requiring a 10% budget reduction on general funds. The commission's budget is not there's a limited amount of our agency that's funded with general funds. All of the coal mining and reclamation permitting and abandoned mine lands are not general funds. That's about half of our agency. So that leaves the public utility division and weights and measures essentially that is general funds. The railroad safety program is funded with special funds. Having gone through this exercise two biennials previously, our options for reductions really got into, cutting programs or cutting staff. And if you're cutting staff more, we already have probably the smallest public utilities staff in the country. And so it got to the point where we questioned whether we could actually do the jobs that were required under law and the state constitution to do. So we looked at alternative forms. It was one of the things that the governor suggested agencies do is look at other ways to generate revenue. A lot of our budget is funded by general funds. Again, that's not a real common way to fund regulatory agencies like ours throughout the nation. A lot of them are funded by users and with various assessments and user fees. So we have proposed in our budget, and we're not sure whether these proposals will be endorsed by the governor or where they're going to fall through the legislative session. They could completely fall off the table immediately. But in order to meet that 10%, we had to come up with some new mechanisms. One of them is self-funding. The biggest one is self-funding. We did cut back as well. What we didn't feel like we could cut, we made up with additional fund generations. We did that throughout all of the areas that we fund with general fund. We increased fees in the weights and measures area and licensing fees there. And we're looking at and have talked through with the utility industry an assessment on their revenues that would help us generate some additional funds for funding our public utilities division, not 100%, not even close to 100%, but would generate about less than $500,000 a year through that site. And then the other piece that we're looking at is siting and have proposed a mechanism that would allow us through siting to recapture some, not all, of the funds that our staff uses to process. Currently, staff time is not charged to companies for the processing of your application, siting application fees. Staff time is paid for from the general fund. So we're not proposing to keep track of every staff hour and recover that. We're just proposing a formula that's pretty modest that would allow us to retain a certain amount of the siting fee dollars per $1 million of application costs. I think currently the proposed language is $100 per million with a maximum of $225,000 per biennium. So that's in our budget proposal. Again, I don't know where that will end up during the legislative process. It might be flatly rejected, or it might not even make it through the governor's process, but it's included as a proposal in our budget. Randy or Brian, you guys want to say anything there?
Sure. Well, sure. I think just in terms of our discussions, and it's not just in this particular area, it's in the other areas, we fully recognize the time is certainly not now, if ever. And I think the governor's office will recognize that as well. But we were given a task, which was to, again, generate a budget reflecting a 10% cut. And as Commissioner Fedorchuk explained, if you take half of our budget and set it aside, because it's federally funded, it really becomes a 20% cut on the remaining portion. And that's just not a tenable position for us to be placed in. So I think that in terms of what we would have to do as an agency, because we absolutely are one of the smallest agencies in the country when you look at the ground that we have to cover in the different areas that we have jurisdiction over. So we want to make sure we can do the job. I don't think this will survive. Certainly not going to advocate that it survives, but we had to demonstrate in areas that we would prefer to not have gone toward, just how the numbers, if we were to make them work, what would it look like? And again, I think that's going to be recognized as not an acceptable option, but that's where we landed. And I don't think anyone on our end will be aggressively pursuing these initiatives and trying to make them happen. But just some further background, Commissioner Christman, I'm done.
Yeah, and just I think to kind of sum up on the explanation of the proposal, Julie, you mentioned the $100 per $1 million of investment with a cap of 25,000 per biennium, but it's 25,000 per project.
Sorry. So, thank you, Rand.
A project over 250 million that would cap out at. And then the other thing, and Brian touched on it, but I just want to reemphasize, I don't think it's any of our hope that this happen. I think we're all 100% focused on getting our budget back to where it is currently for the next biennium at what it is in this biennium. But if in fact we do have to drop back by 10%, which is, as Brian said, is essentially almost, you know, you might say double that in these areas, if we're going to be responsive, we need people. And so this is our proposed fail-safe, and really curious the response. Agree with Brian, terrible timing, but I don't know what else to do either.
Yeah. Yeah, this was, we've discussed this for 5 or 6 months, how to do this. And one of the options, one of the other possibilities would be to farm out through an engineering firm this review of the siting applications, rather than having our staff do that and take the lead on that. That would certainly cut back on staff time and free that up. But it would also chew up more of the siting dollars, which would come out of the siting fee. Those costs would be automatically applied to the fee already collected and then reduce the amount of refund that you'd receive. So that was another option for addressing the issue of how to process the siting. We think it's better to have staff who are in-house, get to know the industry, get to work more directly, can be more responsive to you, and have always tried to protect that, and the industry has supported us in that in the past. And so I think that's what you guys prefer as well. So hopefully, it wasn't lost on any of us that the place where you least want to hurt people is in those who are investing in our state in these tough times. And so that's why we were very hesitant and tried to go about this in the most reasonable, less impactful way. And so with that, certainly would love to hear any of your thoughts on this proposal. Someone has to be first. Or if you just have questions, need clarification on what we're proposing, happy to go through that.
I guess that would be my position, Commissioner Fedorchak, is I guess I'm not quite clear on the proposal you're asking about. Is that more citing dollars used for the review? Is that the overall, what you just laid out in its entirety, or is there specific pieces you're looking for feedback?
So the concept, and I'll just kind of provide it in a nutshell again. So currently you guys have a citing fee that you submit to the office with your application, and we use that fee to cover the costs of processing your application. Currently, the costs that we charge to the siting fee are just the hard costs, like the costs of travel, transportation to the hearing, the cost of the hearing room, the cost of publication, all of those, the legal notices, any attorney's fees for outside counsel that we use. Those are typically the fees that are charged to that fund. Anything we don't use is returned to you, the applicant. What we don't charge today is any of our own costs of staff time, and we don't keep any of an assessment to cover that, those in-house costs. What we're proposing here is that if they desire another way to supplant general funds that currently support us with outside funds, another revenue-creating mechanism, if the legislature and the governor choose to do that, this option would provide that $100 for every $1 million investment for a project, so whatever your application investment is, if $45 million, say, $100 per 45 or per million would be retained by us as a fee to cover part of our costs.
Right, and to tie it together, and it has been, but it was mentioned outsourcing, for example, a part of the review, the trade-off, if we had met the governor's budget request of cutting 10%, if we had to look at a position that was involved in the current review and then are forced to outsource it, I think we lose a degree of control, local control or control at the state level, and that was a significant concern as well. But again, we will see what happens when it is reviewed by the governor's office, and I don't believe it will survive, and again, I don't believe we'll be advocating for it and in any way either. It was just a necessary evil to in order to hit the target that the governor's office put forth to our agency.
Any other questions on that? More general thoughts, concerns? Okay. Well, I don't want to cut short the discussion, but if no one has any thoughts on that, we can come back at the end again and cover it if you're still thinking it over. The second,
Julie, this is Ron. Oh. I think the only discussion is that what are you guys hearing from your peers and your colleagues? And I mean, I suspect every agency is going to be scrapping for support for additional or sustaining their operations, and certainly every agency we deal with. So, you know, we have a hard time prioritizing some of those things in order. What are you hearing across the board and the Capitol? Maybe, and most of the folks on the line probably don't know what you've been requested from a budget standpoint and where you expect it to go.
Yeah. I haven't had a lot of interaction with my other colleagues. Brian, have you, to the other agency heads? Brian's our chair right now, so he's kind of a point person until January.
I've talked to right until January, and then then I'm paroled. But I've talked to three other of the more sizable agencies, and the elected officials that head those up, and they all view it as untenable in terms of the budget request and not being able to meet their constitutional obligation or obligations if they were to cut to that degree. And I won't list the agencies, but again, three of certainly the most sizable agencies in the Capitol that are represented by elected officials. So, you know, just to be blunt, the comment has essentially been, what don't you want us to do? Because agencies have continued to look for efficiencies. I've continued to be impressed with the Public Service Commission in terms of how efficient it is and the ground it covers with such a small staff. I think the other elected officials feel the same way. But it was a request from the governor's office that we were required to meet, and I think legislators are going to hear a very common theme from the different agencies in that we were really put in a very difficult position. We had no choice but to come up with some of these mechanisms, and I think the legislative body will recognize that, and we'll see where that process goes.
And, you know, I think this is a better time to emphasize one of the points you made, Julie, at the beginning. I think this is a better time than it was then. But last spring, in what was it, late March, when the significant COVID restrictions really set in, and we were sitting on some, we weren't sitting on them, we had some siting applications on hand. We got things moving along with the help of the executive order so we could do it outside of the county, but the rest of it was our team that put in place all the tools necessary to hold those hearings within weeks and get approval in time for all the summer construction that has occurred. Had we not had employees here with experience in this area working through that, had we been looking at those applications and saying, well, now we need to go out to some engineering firm and a legal firm and a technology consultant to advise us in how to put that all together, it wouldn't have gone that fast. We wouldn't have been the one of the 50 states that 49 other states were coming to when we were the first regulatory agency in the state that was up and running with our remote hearings and doing it to meet all the legal requirements. Literally 49 other states were behind us on doing that. It was because we had some staff on hand with experience. And if we have to do everything through the siting fee where we can only use it for outside consultants and don't retain something to keep these staff people here, we won't have that flexibility and nimbleness in the future.
Obviously, I think a lot of these kinds of proposals from our agency and others will be dependent on how the revenue numbers look throughout the session and by the end of the session. And it might be the case that they kind of table them and keep them in their back pocket and see how things look as we go and see where numbers need to be met and how the budget needs to be balanced and how they get there. So hopefully those numbers continue to improve. Did that answer your question, Ron?
Yeah, I think it did. And I you know, as you guys know, everybody's going to put all their chips on the table. And I think a plan that's a little unique out of the box is the one that's going to be successful. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, we tried to look at each piece. You know, we all of the, like I said earlier, all the areas that receive general fund are at the table in our proposal and contributing a little bit to the overall goal of reaching that 10%. We cut ourselves. We looked at the electric utilities, weights and measures, and siting. All right. I guess we'll stay tuned and see how that all proceeds. The next little piece that I wanted to throw out here, well, it's not little, but it's not even something that Randy and Brian and I have talked about with this session, but it is something that came up through the Industrial Commission and that they were exploring, and it's something we proposed a few sessions ago. It is not on the table this session, but I do want to throw it out there and get the industry thinking about it, and I would definitely welcome your feedback as we go this session and the next session, and that is in terms of pipeline safety. So currently North Dakota, with the a cooperative agreement with PHMSA, we do the in-state gas pipeline safety program for PHMSA. They handle all of the hazardous liquids and intrastate and interstate everything. It is possible for North Dakota to ask for and work with PHMSA to obtain the certification to do the in-state crude oil safety program. A few sessions ago, I think it was 2015, we did, I think we proposed it, and it would have included hiring a number of new inspectors to cover all that territory. And that program comes with a cost share from the federal government. I forget how much, it's like 75% or something to that effect. It is still something that we could look at doing down the road, and I think there's merit to in-state inspectors. They're more responsive and accountable to, in our case, elected officials who are directly accountable to people and industry, and I like that part of it. I like that they aren't responsive to a, you know, bureaucracy in Washington with regional managers that may or may not have a vested interest in North Dakota and what goes on here. I like that about it. I like that we are responsible for overseeing them and watching their work and seeing how much they're working and keeping track of their days and all of that sort of thing. I think we get more out of our inspectors in general. So I like all of that. It also comes with more responsibility and a portion of it is a budget issue, too, so I don't think this year is the time. But I just wanted to throw it out there. The Industrial Commission, I think, looked at this as a as something that maybe they were going to pursue. Apparently, they are not. It would be a natural to have in the PSC because our inspectors that we already have for the gas could be dually certified and do twice as much as are out there. And so I think it makes sense to combine them wherever they exist, whether it's here or in the Industrial Commission, that should be one program. So I just want to throw that out there and get any initial thoughts if the industry thinks they would support that down the road or open to those discussions of taking on that program in the future and proposing that to the legislature. And I don't know that my colleagues are even 100% supportive, but it would be interesting to hear your thoughts on it. You guys are way more quiet than you are in a room together.
Yeah. Commissioner Fedorchak, this is Brent Lomas with Hess.
Hi, Brent.
Just a question on the FEMSA proposal. Would you also be looking at assuming the audit responsibilities that FEMSA has, or just the inspection side of the program?
Well, that's a good question. Jack?
I think my understanding is it would be substantially similar to the natural gas program, the LNG program, so there would be audits as well under that program as program two. But again, this would be solely for intrastate pipelines.
Your thoughts, Brent? Which do you think it's better to do both or not? What are your thoughts?
My thought would be it would be better to combine both audits and inspections in one department. But
mm-hmm. Do you guys generally have a good relationship with FEMSA? Do you think they do a nice job in our state? Are they as present as you'd like, or too present? What's your reaction to their work currently?
We have a great relationship with FEMSA as we do with the PSC Commission. I think, you know, we just went through a fairly extensive audit with FEMSA as well last year. We also went through a PSC audit, so that it tends to be duplicated. When we do get the audits that come in is kind of where my mind is at. So having them all in one agency would be, for us, would be an advantage because we do see a lot of duplication.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know. Great. All right. Well, if others have thoughts, we're all ears. Otherwise, it's something that we'll just kind of keep in our back pocket, and we can. It's not imminent this session, but it's good to be thinking about down the road. All right. That leads me to potential tweaks to the footprint law. And I'm kind of forgetting what we had in mind to talk about here, and we might have already covered it in our legislative proposals. But, Ron, I have to lean on you because this was the agenda came from an early morning text exchange that we had, and I somehow lost that text exchange. So I can't remember what we talked about here or if it was my idea or yours.
This was an idea that you had. You referred to it as a minor technical change that you thought we would be supportive of, and you were hopeful that industry could pose this. And I would just, for everybody's recollection, and maybe Todd Crandon can help me, but the footprint bill and then the re-footprint bill, I believe, were 2013 and 2015 versions. These bills were a tremendous amount of work. led by Representative George Kaiser. And I think certainly from an industry standpoint, they've given us a very clear pathway in terms of moving projects along and trying to minimize some of the some of those wait times that we were all just kind of sitting on shuffling paper. And I think from our standpoint, they've worked very, very well. And Todd Kranda, our contract lobbyist, deserves a tremendous amount of credit, along with your staff at the commission, for making this work. And it's also something that, if we're going to move forward with the bill, I think we should contemplate kind of who that next guru might be in the legislature, because if you find a champion of issues like this, you like to ride them, and I'm not sure that Representative Kaiser will seek another term or not, but he certainly should be asked to sponsor any legislation, but we should think about having a cohort with him.
Okay, great, Ron, thank you.
So it's your idea. I just call back to you.
All right. I think it's stemming from a meeting we had last week, and so I think maybe Casey Fury, if she's on, would be able to shine some light on this, or perhaps Brian Johnson or Pat Fawn. I think it's from the discussion we had over some of the changes in the Senex project.
Well, yeah, it had to do with the route deviations.
Yeah, and there was just a minor adjustment to the language that we thought would clarify things. Wasn't there, Randy? I'm so sorry I didn't write this down.
I don't have it with me either, but the dilemma was trying to make, you know, as we get better detail on mapping and such, we find these route deviations and some of them could be significant, so it has to be taken seriously, but they might be so minimal, too, that...
That's what it was, wasn't it? We were going to suggest the solution would be to, right now, the law requires that the route is where the pipeline is actually constructed, and if it deviates from that route line, then... The company has to let us, they have to let us know before they can proceed. They don't have to get our approval. They just have to let us know before they can proceed with the change. So if there's crews out in the field and they're constructing and they deviate because maybe they don't even know how much they've deviated because it's hard to say, but once we get the as-built maps, it's different than what we had at the hearing, and so technically then it's not following the route. And so we wanted to provide more flexibility that the company could not have, they could deviate if it's an impact to, if the route changes but it doesn't affect an avoidance or exclusion area, they can deviate and let us know at the end or after. They don't have to let us know that they're deviating beforehand. That's what
right.
It was.
The one example, Senex, if I remember correctly, it was a 2 or 3 foot deviation in some spots within a 200 foot wide construction corridor. So it shifted ever so slightly, but they were required to go through the process of telling us about the route adjustment. When you're putting a pipeline in the ground, a 24 to 30 inch variance is not unusual during the construction process, but it's and there's already protections in place for cultural resources, environmentally sensitive habitat, things like that. It's already a part of the process to begin with. So again, I think it's just a common sense approach to grant the type of flexibility. Because, again, the route corridor has already been examined. The steps have already been taken to ensure that that construction corridor has the green light to proceed with putting pipe in the ground or whatever the facility might be. So,
yeah, the key word being notifying us prior to the deviation. So, Todd, maybe you and Brady and Jack can talk and look at that specific and see if it's something you guys want to proceed with changing, because I do think, and Casey Fury would be a good one to consult with too, because she's the attorney on that Senex project, which saw a lot of these. There was a ton of deviations in that construction that ended up being just kind of a paperwork nightmare for them. So,
and I think in some of these instances before GIS, these things wouldn't have even been noticed, but we see things now. And I think a key in solving this in a good way is going to be using good judgment. You know, and I want to also highlight one of the places where these deviations can be significant and totally accidental is with the underground boring. Sometimes those things stray and you literally are doing it and don't even know you did it until the end. But if a developer chooses to really thread a needle, for instance, you know, a 500-foot setback from a residence who does not approve of the project and chooses to just go, you know, say 501 feet away, well, then you meet the threshold. But now if you have a deviance of a few feet, you got a problem too. And so we can sit in the middle of almost nowhere with a 200-foot corridor and say, yeah, what difference does it make if the route veers a few feet one way or the other from that route? Doesn't matter. It's just out there. But like I say, if you're threading the needle or if you're in an area where there's other pipelines or other pipelines expected and you veer a few feet over, well, does that mean that now there's not enough corridor left for the next developer to put one more thing in before the hard and fast, you know, the residence that doesn't approve or something like that? So it's really important that judgment be used. And so it's going to be kind of sticky writing legislation to allow that all.
I can see your point, Randy. I think that, though, it's important to remember that this would only apply in cases where there's no exclusion or avoidance areas involved. And in the case like that, there is an exclusion area. It's 500 feet from the house. So I feel like all that this would do would take, in the cases where companies operating in an area where there's no exclusion or avoidance areas and there's a deviation, they need to let us know, but they don't have to let us know before they deviate. And it just seems like maybe that was something that was intended originally and just not included in the original drafting. But that's where, Todd, I think your involvement is key, because you were the one that drafted all those. And maybe you wanted it this way. So.
And it's really something that's kind of developed with two current cases where there's quite a few of these deviations that we're just trying to get through with the existing law.
Okay.
Since we already have the Siting Act, and we're working on that, would that be something we would be looking at putting in our current proposal? It looks like it'd be a fairly minor change specific to one small area on the Siting Act.
I'm open to it, just because they'd probably be blended together anyway in the legislative process.
Right.
So I think so. But again, I think if the industry wants us, let us know. It's not currently one of our proposals. But I think I would be looking for your support and your involvement in making the case for this during the legislature.
I believe it's beneficial for industry and the public is still adequately protected because of the reasons mentioned, whether it's distance from a residence, whether it's a cultural resource that is found along the route. And one bit of background information. I did ask the question, and I think the answer was that the commission has never not approved a deviation. And when you think of all of the projects over the years, the fact that we've never not given approval for a deviation because of the other protections in place, I think that's telling that companies at times are having to go through a few more steps than are actually necessary from a practical standpoint.
So I'd imagine then, if that was the case, on their final filing of GIS data, they would actually be able to provide a certification at that time on what you guys are providing.
Right.
Okay.
Ken, had thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I don't envy Jack or Todd trying to put together this language, but I do think that it makes a lot of sense, and especially in light of your conversation earlier with budget difficulties and your staff's time. There's no sense in creating more paper shuffle than is necessary, unless it's important to protect something. So I think if you get the language framed so that it protects those avoidance areas, those exclusion areas, and allows the maximum latitude for the developer within those confines and within the corridor, and that just makes great sense, and it saves everybody a lot of hassle, a lot of paper trouble.
Very good. That's the goal. Brady?
Commissioner, I sure appreciate you bringing this issue up. I think the concept on its face seems like a fairly easy change. Myself, I'll offer my assistance to help craft the language along with Todd Kranda, who's the expert on this issue for us. Look forward to working with Jack on crafting a potential bill and circulating that internally to make sure that it works for everyone involved.
Very good.
Would this be something better for you to find a legislator to sponsor it, or for it to be an agency bill? We could attach it to the bills we've already discussed, but we have till Friday to submit these things. So,
Commissioner, I think we can. I don't think we'd have a problem finding a legislator to do it. Like Ron talked about, we have certain champions of pipeline issues, so we can get that done. We would like Jack's input, though, and making sure that it's working for everyone's interest and not going to create a headache with the commission.
Why don't we look at what the language would you come up with and see how it fits with what we're already proposing, and if it seems like a one-off or doesn't really flow, then maybe we look at a legislative sponsor.
We do already have this section being amended for minor changes.
Yeah.
So if we do have the time, we could add in there if we could add something quick.
Okay. However it works out, I'm open to either. Okay, very good. That was the tweak. Figured it out. Yes. not losing my mind. All right, we're moving on to the final piece, which is other policy issues or concerns. This is kind of like the open mic section. I don't have any other policy issues or concerns to bring up. I don't see Randy or Brian having any, or our staff. Pafon, do you have any other policy issues or concerns you want to highlight?
No, I don't have anything additional.
Okay, thank you, Pat. So if any of your crew has anything, or your members, we'd love to hear about it.
And if I could, just to throw out to everybody that's tuned in, didn't have anything to do with oil and gas, but we were just informed of a piece of legislation that some industry people are contemplating and sought input. I don't know, first I seen of it was yesterday. And I don't know that we're going to have anything to add to it or not, but I did have one concern. I'm not sure if it needs to be addressed or not, I guess is my point. But so if you have things that you're working on that you care to share with us, and you know that we might be able to help perfect in advance, we're here and happy to do that. It's easier in a conversation like this than in front of a committee, and time is short and all the other things like that. So I'm just curious about if you have anything like that we can be of assistance with.
It's a great point, Randy. I wonder, Ron or Brady, if you want to give a highlights of your legislative agenda.
Commissioner Fedorchak and other commissioners, I know that our legislative agenda is still in development. Legislative committee is meeting. They're going to start meeting regularly here, beginning with its another meeting on Monday of next week. Big topics are still in the development phase. Big focus on Bakken restart initiatives and what might move the needle in keeping those investment dollars in North Dakota. Other than that, I think we're focusing on staying steady and doing what we can to survive. In terms of other issues, I know that gas capture, remote gas capture incentive package is being put together that we're working on. It essentially boils down to an extraction tax exemption up to 2.5% for remote capture. We're still getting the language just right before we roll it out for public consumption, but that's the plan with the remote gas capture. That's very much meant to target the stranded gas areas that don't have access to gathering lines or areas where gathering line capacity is in short supply. So that's probably going to be a big focus for us. Other than that, we're keeping our legislative strategy very, very focused on 2 to 3, maybe 4 big issues, and reserving the rest of our strength. And as we all know, it's going to be a legislative session that's going to be very different from anything most of us have ever experienced before. So we're doing our best to focus and keep the legislative process moving and flowing smoothly.
Thank you, Brady. To the extent I know, there's talk about there's more crossover probably this session than in the past on oil and gas and electric utility type of issues as it relates to perhaps CO2 sequestration or use incentives for use by the industry, as well as incentives to generate electricity from natural gas. So to the extent that you all are involved in those or hear about those and can keep us in the loop, obviously we've got our feelers out as well, but can keep us in the loop on that, those tend to implicate things that we're involved in on the electric side, and it's helpful to know what they are and to be engaged in those from our standpoint too. So if you can help us with that, that would be great.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. And again, I want to express our appreciation for the commission sitting down and having this conversation. It's truly a wonder in North Dakota. I mean, as business-friendly as we champion ourselves as being, seeing it in practice is very amazing. And we really do appreciate it. So thank you again.
It helps us do our jobs better, so we appreciate your guys' time. All right. If there's no other issues, then I think that we can be adjourned, and we'll look forward to having another discussion probably after the legislative session and sort of do a rundown of what happened. And then, but hopefully we'll stay in good close contact throughout the session as issues come up. Always know that our doors are open and we want to talk about things as proactively as possible. So many thanks for your time.
And maybe just a tentative plan for a end of first quarter check with this group again or something. We'll have a little legislative update. You know, everybody gets those from our perspective, but it might just, who knows what's going to be happening by the mid first quarter or March or so. So maybe we should just plan to get back on our schedule for at least biannual meetings.
Until yes.
I think that would be really excellent, because mm-hmm. by then we'll have been actually maybe 2 to 4 or 5 weeks past crossover, kind of see what's been developing, how proposals have fared, what things came up that maybe neither of us now are even aware of at this time, and plan for how to handle April and the end of the session.
Sounds like a deal. One more plug. Tessa worked extremely hard over the weekend. It's Giving Hearts Day today, and she has set up a number of giving charities out across the Bakken and in Western North Dakota. If any of you out there have it in your spirit today to make a contribution or a gift, any of the good causes across North Dakota, you can go to our Petroleum Council Foundation website. We sent that link out yesterday, and she just did an unbelievable job of creating a simplistic way for information and how to make contributions today during Giving Hearts Day. So.
Great. Perfect way to end.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it. Thanks for your time, everyone. Merry Christmas.